Rich Lenkoff joins us now here on WGN. You know his voice here pretty well. Of course, he's the co-host of Legal Face-Off at WGNRadio.com, capital member at Downey Lenkoff, and a producer, too, Rich. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you? Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Ashley, who's filling in for Pete today, mentioned that you are producing a show that's at the Apollo Theater starting soon?
I am. Actually, our cast was on WGN TV this morning for a few segments. The show is called The Choir of Man. It's a musical that is running, as you said, at the Apollo Theater on Lincoln. We just got extended, actually, until July, so that's great. The concept is it is a 90-minute musical set in an English pub, and the cast is all British guys, except for a couple of local amazing cast members, actually, and they are just singing contemporary pop songs, talking a little bit about stories, and they interact with the audience. They serve beer, actually, real beer to the audience, so it's a real fun show.
I love that. That's cool. Multi-talented man, Rich. All right, well, let's talk about what we brought you here today. You've just been kind of poking in and out of the Trump trial. Today was, I think it's day two, but it was closed off to the jury, the first part, the hearing on the gag order. Can you set this one up a little bit, Rich, and then let us know what kind of went down in the trial today?
Yeah, well, the gag order, the judge, Judge Merchan, heard arguments about whether Trump is violating the gag order. We know that he has talked extensively about the judge and his family. The prosecutor has alleged that he is violating that gag order. So that's what was going on this morning. They are back in the regular trial. The David Pecker testimony, the National Enquirer editor, is continuing. That will be one of the central figures who will testify in the trial, of course, about this alleged catch and kill scheme.
I don't know if you've actually gotten to read anything about what went down in the gag order back and forth. I was just seeing some on X, and again, I haven't read deeply into it, but it seemed to be not going well for Trump's lawyers. I think the judge asked a few times directly if Trump acknowledged, the former president, was even acknowledging the fact that he had violated the gag order. Couldn't seem to get a direct answer out of him. I don't know. Have you been following that at all or just kind of passively checking in? What do you think?
I've been checking the updates. I mean, it looks like, I know Bragg asked Trump to pay a $1,000 fine for each of the alleged infractions. I saw what you mentioned about the judge, the judge's feelings about that. The allegation is that he violated the gag order 10 times. So, for a regular person, that's a lot of money. It's just more, fuel on the fire for what Trump is paying in this case. But yeah, that part of the case doesn't seem to be going well for Trump. And again, to any layperson, I think it seems clear that he is violating that gag order. The gag order is pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah. All right, we'll monitor that as we go throughout the day today. The reason I really wanted to talk with you, Rich, is kind of this fascinating story that impacts a lot more than just one small town in Oregon. To set this up a little bit, I'll just do this the best I can, and you can let me know if I did anything wrong. In Boise, Idaho, years ago, they were fining homeless people or people experiencing homelessness for sleeping in parks, or they were trying to remove them, essentially, but putting all these barriers in place to not let people who are experiencing homelessness sleep. The Ninth Court of Appeals, which oversees the West Coast of the United States, basically said that it violated the Eighth Amendment, that was a cruel and unusual punishment, that sleeping is a human right, and you can't put undue burdens on people that are homeless from catching a night of sleep, especially if there aren't any beds available in shelters. Like, if you aren't providing them an opportunity to sleep, then you can't yell at them for sleeping outside or fine them or whatever it may be. That was not taken up by the Supreme Court, in a sense, leaving that there. And now we have this case in Oregon where they're challenging that, a small town that has a real libertarian tilt to it, saying that is really not right. That is messing up our town. We can't do anything to prevent these people from sleeping in our parks, et cetera, et cetera. It's changing the makeup of the town. And Rich, my run of it is that even some liberal side of things are arguing to see have the Supreme Court kind of get rid of this Boise ruling. Did I do an okay job summing that up?
Yeah, you did a great job. It's actually globally kind of a simple issue, right? Whether homelessness can be criminally outlawed. The more fine point in this case, and of course these cases really do turn on some fine points, and what the Supreme Court doesn't just take up a case and think about, well, whether homelessness is unconstitutional. They have to pick up a case. In this case, they're arguing this, as you mentioned, this Grant Pass Oregon statute that may violate this California ruling from 1962. But what was really interesting, in addition to what you said, was, you know, there's this back and forth with the justices as to whether homelessness is a status or whether it's conduct. Under, if it was conduct, the Robinson case stands for the idea that you can be punished. In other words, it's just being homeless conduct. Well, if it is associated, as Clarence Thomas said, with the use of drugs or committing crimes, then certainly that seems like it could be banned. If, on the other hand, homelessness is just status, and it's no different than, I think Elena Kagan said, no different than breathing, how could that be outlawed? And as you mentioned, that does seem to violate the Eighth Amendment protection against cruel and unusual punishment. So it's really an interesting kind of dissection of what it means to be homeless, and we'll see how they rule. But I agree with you that even some of the more liberal justices who are in the minority had some arguments against this ordinance.
Yeah, even Gavin Newsom signed on, I think he did an amicus brief about it, or at least joined the side of hoping the court at least clarifies what they meant, in, or what the Ninth Circuit meant in their ruling years ago with the Boise statute. It's interesting, right? Like, if someone is doing drugs on the street, although I know different states now have different rules on how they handle that, but I could see, yes, police can issue a citation or a violation or bring someone in on a criminal charge. But the idea of whether you can cite someone for a trespass if you don't have anywhere for them else to go, like, what level does a town have to provide a shelter? Like, in this small town in Oregon I was reading, they don't have a homeless shelter where people can just freely go. There is a religious center that is open that has limitations on who can go into one of the beds. So I guess the argument really is, if you as a town are not providing a place for people to sleep, this basic human right, is that cruel and unusual? And if it is, then you need to let people sleep in the park or on a bench if that's what the case is. It really has ramifications depending on which way they go with this, Rich.
Everything you're saying and everything that was argued yesterday drills down to an incredibly important point, which is that these cases exist in real life. And what this case, I thought, did a good job, or at least the justices did a pretty good job at analyzing yesterday, was the implications of these ordinances and their rulings on everyday life and the logistical issues involved in, you know, either upholding or overturning this kind of ban, right? They did talk, which you don't hear that often, frankly, from the Supreme Court as to the logistics, but they did talk about, well, to your point, what happens if we uphold this ban? Where do these people go? Are they supposed to just, I think Sotomayor said, are they supposed to just die? So, you know, it's interesting because this, over the weekend, Stephen Breyer, who is now off the Supreme Court, was talking about a new book he wrote, and he was talking about, you know, he was questioned extensively, I think it was on Meet the Press or one of the other Sunday shows, about whether the justices consider the implications of their rulings on everyday life. And he admitted that, frankly, yes, I mean, that we try not to let that impact our decision, but it's impossible to not literally hear what's going on outside the Supreme Court walls and figuratively. So this is an interesting example of how the Supreme Court doesn't just operate in this legal vacuum, and they're not simply academic. They're actually considering the practical implications of their rulings.
That's interesting. And I also imagine that permeates into the decisions whether they even take cases or not, right? Like, is this an issue that is now blown up to a scale that politicians can't seem to figure this out? We need to step in, because the Supreme Court takes the vast, vast minority of cases that are presented to it. Even by taking a case, it signals a, hey, we need to get into this heated debate.
No question. And again, I think one of the takeaways here is that, you know, it might be good news to you or bad news, depending on where you sit on this issue. But the Supreme Court, you know, isn't shy about taking on a controversial case that impacts people's real lives. We've seen, you know, high profile examples of, you know, crimes involving homeless people, some of them migrants. So, you know, listen, Supreme Court justices are people. They go to the grocery store, they talk to their neighbors, they read social media. So they know that these cases are on the minds of the general public. And that, your point, does play into their decision as to whether they take it up.
Oh, yeah, actually. Can you stay on, Rich? We got a couple other stories I want to get to, okay?
For sure, yes.
Rich Lankoff, we'll have more on that. Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com. We'll get to that after this. All right, Rich Lankoff, you ready to pivot to some other stuff?
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
What's going on with our movie theaters and our drinks? Apparently someone's upset about this.
Well, yeah, you know, we cover these lawsuits all the time on Legal Face-Off. You know, and the idea is that we are victims of shrinkage when it comes to retail products. You know, there's been lots of high profile cases of, you know, sandwiches not being quite 12 inches, or, you know, the chips you're buying don't have quite the amount of chips that they are alleging. Well, in this latest lawsuit, the allegation is that there is a class action that is being harmed because your soda at your movie theater is not the same size that it is being sold to you as. And that is, you know, of course, causing irreparable harm to the plaintiffs.
Is it, does the whole case rest on whether it's advertised as smaller than before, or do, if a movie theater, does the lawsuit allege, changes the size of cups, they need to publicize that because otherwise people will think that they're getting what they always got?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a great question. It's both, really. It's the idea that, you know, this individual who filed the suit in Texas in federal court, so this is, you know, a federal issue. You know, people joke, you're making a federal crime or something. This is the allegation in this, in my opinion, frivolous lawsuit. So the allegation is that he purchased a 20-ounce and 24-ounce drink, but realized that the cups only hold a maximum of 22 ounces of fluid. So the allegation is that he was harmed by this difference, and that the defendant, in this case Cinemark, was engaged in deceptive and improper business practices, violating, you know, state laws, which are the same as federal laws. So, you know, I guess it's both that he was harmed and that they are engaged in these deceptive practices.
I know we are an over-litigious society. Why do you say that's frivolous, though? I'm curious. How shouldn't there be guardrails, or are you arguing there already are guardrails in place and taking this to federal court is overkill?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, the idea when you're buying something is not necessarily that you're going to be getting exactly the same amount that they advertise. There's some leeway there, I believe, and, you know, 22 versus 21 and a half. That's one thing. The second thing is, you know, we always analyze cases, or at least, you know, most of us do, in terms of what the damages are. What are the damages to someone who, you know, bought a 22-ounce drink and only got 21 ounces? Now, the I understand that as a class, the idea is that this is affecting many people rather than this individual. But, you know, I mean, suing Oreo because you don't believe that the amount of cream in the middle of a double stuff, are there really no better uses for our courts than that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I agree that it does clog up the courts a little bit. And you're right, what's the harm? I guess we could all sign on and get a penny or two back from the theaters if they win. All right, let's talk about Luke Bryan, who I'd heard that he had fallen on stage. I didn't realize why he had fallen and what happens next. Walk us through this story a bit.
Yeah, he was in Vancouver at a show on Saturday, and he was walking across the stage, and of course, everyone's videotaping, so there's a million, you know, there's hundreds of images of him, and he suddenly slips and falls on something, pretty violent fall, falls backwards, and it's discovered that he fell on a cell phone of a fan that was thrown on stage, and he immediately gave the phone to the fan and said, "You'll hear from my lawyer," somewhat in jest. But, you know, the bigger picture issue here is this trend of fans engaging too closely with performers on stage, resulting in injuries. I mean, we saw, I think, it was Cardi B recently. She had a cell phone thrown at her. She violently threw it back. There's a couple other artists. Bebe Rexha was involved in an incident where she actually got, like, a swollen eye from it. This is another example. So, so there is certainly some legal exposure for the fan if they can figure out who that is.
Right.
There's also exposure for, you know, the arena, for security, for allowing this stuff to happen. So I don't think Luke Bryan is injured from it, speaking of, you know, what are the actual damages, but there is this trend of fans feeling liberated in throwing things at performers, which is just kind of wacky, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. I think if someone gets caught throwing something at something, they should be criminally charged with it. I don't think Luke Bryan should have to go to civil court to seek damages for a fall, although I guess that could be the next thing. The interesting angle is, yeah, do arenas now have to start anticipating this, protecting performers like they do at baseball games? Are we going to start seeing nets in front of the stages to start protecting performers, even though they want that one-on-one connection with the fans? I don't know, Rich.
Yeah, exactly. We've seen a couple of occasions where performers have put up screens, I mean, see-through screens, but because of this. So, you know, if you don't want that, if you want to be close to your performer, up throwing stuff at them.
Sure. All right, Rich Linkoff, we're just about out of time. Let us know what's coming up on the next Legal Face-Off at WGNRadio.com. What do you got in the hopper?
Yeah, we will be recording our next show tomorrow. We'll be releasing it tomorrow evening. We're discussing a lot of these topics. We are also discussing the Shohei Ohtani gambling scandal. We have an expert on about that. We are actually joined by Gloria Allred,
wow,
one of the most well-known attorneys in the country. She's a frequent guest on our show. She will be discussing the legacy of O.J. Simpson. She, of course, represented some of the victims of O.J. Simpson. And we're also discussing, we've got a great jury consultant on discussing the Trump hush money jurors and how that might look in a verdict. So, yeah, lots of interesting topics.
I was shocked. One publication put out a list of where do the jurors get their news and information from? They aggregated from the process. And I was very jealous, Rich. A lot of them don't get a lot of news anywhere. And some days I wish maybe I could try that too, huh?
Right, right. Turn it off. Although I was interested, at least two of them I saw were fans of both Fox and MSNBC. That's probably what you want.
I saw that too. Exactly. Yeah, they watch a little MSNBC. They watch a little Fox. Preferably they watch a lot of News Nation, and they're the perfect juror. Rich, we appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.